Members, we're at quorum, so we're going to convene the meeting and get started. And first up, we have House File 3172, Representative Cornish. I'm wondering, Representative McFarland, if you would care to move House File 3172.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator McFarland moves House File 3172 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation and Transit Policy Division. Good morning, Representative Cornish. You are probably the first one here, guess.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I learned my lesson once I was late and wound up in a 45-minute difference till the next presenter. Mr. Chair and members, House File 3172 is now passed the Education Committee and the Transportation Committee in the Senate. Senator Rosen is my counterpart over there carrying this. And just a brief description before I turn it over to Superintendent Brules from St. Clair. In 1971, there was a law passed restricting advertisements within right-of-way of highways around churches and schools. And there was a kind of a disagreement whether the language is permissive or restrictive. And what we're looking for is a fix. St. Clair would like to advertise. I did get an amendment, but it wasn't within the 24-hour limit, and I didn't have it distributed yet. So we're considering introducing it at the Transportation Committee if you pass us on that far. And it is kind of a simple fix that it came up from MnDOT to us. And I guess they've had other requests. And when you look at the original language, it just adds without the consent of the church or school. And it seems to be their fix. The language in front of you in House File 3172 is the mirror language that has passed the two committees in the Senate, however. And so, and with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll turn it over to Superintendent Brules from the St. Clair School District, who will explain kind of the background of it shortly.
Representative Cornish, I do see a DE1 amendment in our packet. So is it your intent to move that amendment at this committee hearing?
You have a copy of that, so I could.
Why don't we have Representative Cornish look at that, and we'll hear in from Superintendent Brules. Looks like he's looking at the amendment, too, so we'll give them both an opportunity to do that.
That would be fine. Yes, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Superintendent. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Just to try to keep this as brief as possible and clarify where we're coming from with this is we have a baseball field, and in fact, our whole athletic complex and all of our school campus lies adjacent to Trunk Highway 83 in St. Clair, Minnesota. Our school district, with the support and assistance of our athletic boosters, had an idea last year about this time to sell advertising to be placed inside of our baseball field for the purposes of raising funds. It would not be intended to be displayed for the purpose of motorists. It would be intended to be viewed by the people watching the baseball game and other activities that were taking place inside the athletic facility. We went about the permitting process and discovered that permits weren't available to churches or schools due to the interpretation of the 1971 statute. That prompted talking to Representative Cornish and Senator Rosen to help us come up with some kind of a remedy for this issue. And the simplest way we thought we could do this was through the legislation that you have before you. I know there's been a couple amendments. Some of the discussion on the Senate side was to restrict the bill to St. Clair because we haven't done the necessary research to know what the implications would be statewide. But the amendment that Representative Cornish showed me is a little different than the Senate side, but it accomplishes the same thing, and I'm perfectly in support of that as well. As I'm sure the committee knows, school districts do have the right to advertise, and many districts do sell advertising in parts of their building, especially on athletic complexes. What restricts us is the fact that we have two conflicting statutes. One is the statute that allows us to advertise, but it conflicts with the Outdoor Advertising Control Act of 1971, and we're in that situation precisely because what I've said before, our property adjoins Highway 83.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Cornish, I certainly don't want to muck up your bill relative to the Senate bill, so I leave it to you in terms of what you wish to do with this amendment at this point.
Mr. Chair, I've had that explained to me now, the DE1 amendment, and that makes sense. That's under the purview of this committee. And the change we're thinking about possibly would be in the Transportation Committee, but this restricts it, the DE1 amendment, to just the location at this school, because the original language had the school district and could include other fields. So this ties it down more to just this location near Highway 83. So if I could offer the DE1 amendment.
Representative McFarland, would you offer the DE1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring it in accordance with the author's desire to add the DE1 amendment.
Very well. Members, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I have no further testimony. If you would appreciate your support in this fix, I think the way that it should be to allow this small school to do some advertising and move it on to the Transportation Committee if we would.
Very well. We have a couple questions. Representative Faust and Representative Obermuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, Representative Cornish, when you started speaking, you said that the baseball field was in the highway right away, and I don't think that would be possible, would it?
Representative Cornish.
You're correct. I misspoke. It near the right of way. The regulation has to do within so many feet of the right of way, and so it wouldn't be in the right of way, no.
Representative Faust, I have the 35E Parkway, which in some parts of my district, butts right up against people's backyards. So I don't know if that's in the right of way or not, but there are peculiar situations. Representative Obermuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have two questions. One is the amendment you're going to put on or you're considering putting on in transportation. I thought you said it would be that they would be able to do this without permission of the school or church. And if you could just clarify I'm not understanding the context and what that would be.
Representative Cornish.
Superintendent
Brules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, this current statute prohibits advertising devices within 100 feet of the church of a church or school, and the amendment would add on the phrase "without the consent of the church or school" at the end. So, in effect, what it would do is it would continue to preclude advertising within 100 feet unless the church or the school provided that permission to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question.
Representative Obermuller.
If this law were to become law, who would actually be determining the content of the advertisement? Would that be under the same way we do it for internal school issues now? In other words, the school board?
Yes, we have a school board policy that we've adopted, recommended by the Minnesota School Boards Association, that we use to guide our advertising.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against the bill? We have a couple questions still. Representative Defke and Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the superintendent. Representative Obermiller's question was one that I had as well, and I just wanted to clarify again. Are you concerned that the church or the school might vote against this? Is that why you put that language in without the permission of the church or school?
Superintendent Brules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What the amendment would do would continue to prevent any entity from advertising on school or church property unless the school or the church granted permission to that entity to advertise. Right now, there's no advertising permitted within 100 feet of a school or church. Or their property. And what this amendment would do would give the school or the church discretion to decide who or what would be able to advertise on or within 100 feet of their property. So it gives them the opportunity to grant permission for advertising, but it doesn't require them to. And in my reading of the amendment, it wouldn't indicate to me that another entity would have the authority or the right to put up advertising without the church's or the school's approval.
Superintendent, or representative, that be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Ms. Larson if she could confirm that, if that's your understanding of it, that the advertising could not be put up without the permission of the church or the school.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Depke, we're talking about two separate laws here, one in the transportation code and the other in the education code. In the education code, we have authority under 123B025 that allows school boards to enter into contracts for advertising. The law has been in effect since 2003. There is a separate section in the transportation code that conforms with federal transportation requirements, and it prohibits placing ads within 100 feet of a school or church. That section of law is not before this committee.
Representative.
Thank you very much, Ms. Larson.
Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Depke has partly asked the questions I wanted. Considering this church is adjacent to the school, ball field, have you had a discussion with them? Are they neutral on this issue? Are they opposed? Do they support the school's proposal? And a second one, if I may ask at the same time, would these advertisements be simple ones, or are they electronic, or what?
Superintendent Brewer.
Mr. Chair, the school that I represent would be the entity that would be authorizing the sale of the advertising. The advertisements themselves would be painted signs, I'd imagine, out of some type of plywood to be attached to the inside of the fence of the ball field. Not large signs, but enough to so that there would be a number of advertisers, much like you might see on ball fields in towns that sell advertising. Not intended to be seen about from the highway, but incidentally they may be seen from the highway, but that wouldn't be the purpose of them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask the same question again then. The question is, have you discussed it with the church that's in proximity to the field? What is their response to it? Can the signs be seen from the church, for example?
Superintendent Brules.
Mr. Chair,
there is not a church next to the ball field, is that what?
Superintendent Brules.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, it's by coincidence there is, but the statute as it stands right now names schools and churches as two separate entities that cannot advertise, and that's why the church and the school are paired together in statute.
Separation of church and state, Representative.
I guess that's very clear in this case. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well, members. Representative McFarland renews her motion that House File 3172, as amended, be recommended to pass and pass to the Committee on Transportation Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cornyn.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent Brules.
Thank you, Chair, members.
I thought it was all one committee. It was one committee.
Representative Newton, House File 2867. Representative Newton moves that House File 2867 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, I also have two amendments to the bill.
Very well. Would you wish to move those at this point, Superintendent?
Yes.
I've got Superintendent on my mind, Representative.
The first amendment is H2867A1, the A1 amendment.
Members, Representative Newton moves the H2867A1 amendment. And is this amendment that puts the bill in the shape you wish it to be?
That's correct, Mr.
Well.
Chair, and it's an amendment that was worked out with all the interested parties and the Department of Education.
Very well. Members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Newton.
And I also have the H2867A2 amendment, Mr. Chair, that further clarifies the bill.
Representative Newton moves the H2867A2 amendment. And again, Representative Newton, this puts the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We now have the bill before us as you wish it to be.
Yes, Mr. Chair. As you know, we've been working with MSBA, NAMI, and the Department of Education, and multiple other interested groups to try to come up with clarification language on special ed to make sure that it really meets the purposes that we're attempting to meet. I have here today Mr. Tom Deans from MSBA and Ms. Elaine Keefe from, she'll be representing the NAMI group also, who would like to testify. Yes, Mr. Chair, while we're on the bill itself, I would like to make an author's amendment on the original bill on line 1.15, and it's simply to delete the new language there. The language is redundant.
I think you can incorporate that into your original amendment. Is that, that makes sense? No, because we've already changed it. Very well. Representative Newton moves that on line 1.15 to delete the new language, the words "and" for that reason, and the comma, I suppose, as well.
Yes, yes, all, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Newton.
I would like to turn it over to Mr. Deans.
Good morning, Mr. Deans.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel to the School Boards Association. This bill really is making technical changes to the special education law with one major exception, and that is the age 21 provisions that the special education can continue until the child becomes 21, and then it specifies when if they turn 21 during the school year, they can continue until the last day of school, and then it defines when the last day of school is, and that's the last day of special instruction and services. Now, Ms. Chair, just for the record, I'm only speaking to the A1 amendment. I'm not speaking to the A2 amendment. That language was around last year, but I don't exactly remember what it does, so I'm not speaking to that language. The A1 amendment has been worked out with MSBA and all the management groups and the Coalition for Children with Disabilities and the various special education advocacy groups.
Very well. Representative Newton.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, which includes the Pacer Center and a number of other advocacy organizations. And we have worked this language out with the School Boards Association and are in support of the bill. We view this as clarification and a continuation of the work that we did last year on special education. Thank you.
Ms. Keefe, and are your comments also to the language that we incorporated or amended on with A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment and the oral amendment, I think we are neutral on the A2 amendment.
Representative Newton, I probably jumped a little bit too fast. We probably needed to have a more separate discussion on the A2 amendment, but nonetheless, the language is before us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment, what it does essentially is removes the word resident so that a parent of a child with a disability doesn't have to be a resident of the district. They can have their child enrolled in another district, but it's up to that district to provide the special education.
And Representative Newton, on lines 1.6 through 1.8, what is the effect of that language?
the effect, pardon me, Mr. Chair, the effect of the language is essentially that the school district has to provide the funding up to the level that they're reimbursed by the federal government and state government for special ed.
Representative Newton, we have reference to a non-public school or facility. Oh, I'm sorry. I see that up above as well.
Yeah.
Any questions for Mr. Dean or Ms. Keefe? Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who it's best directed to, but I'm concerned about the change from provide that where we used to go from provide special education and special instruction to now we can make it available. Is this, and I'm concerned about some school districts who are going to be under money crunches given what we're doing to them that might contract with a school that's a long ways away, but now have an opportunity to say we're making it available, although we're not providing it. And is that a concern that, that schools might somehow be able to pass off their special ed costs onto other schools?
And Representative Obermueller, you're referencing the language.
Sorry, it's the A1 amendment on 1.15 to 1.
Well.
Oh, I'm sorry, 1.5 to 1.6.
Thank you. Mr. Deans?
Mr. Chair, the reason that language is there is the federal law says you must make it available. And this is not a change in that. What happens, though, is we have to say, here's your special education program. The parents have an unlimited right to say, no, we're not taking that. We don't want your special ed. So this says we have to make it available to them. It's their choice whether they take it.
Representative Falls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, I guess. The first one is on the A1 amendment. My understanding of this change is that the change on the date of who's eligible actually moves it back 2 months. So there will be the children born in July and August that would have been eligible to stay in the school system for that year all of a sudden will not be. Is that correct? That there's 2 months worth of children born that qualify for one less year than what they would have previously?
Mr. Dean.
Mr. Chair, the current law says it must be provided from birth until July 1 after the child with a disability becomes 21. So once you become 21, you're supposed to be able to get it till July 1. This says that they can get it till the end of the school year. If the last day of classes in the school year is June 8th or something, they would get special ed till June 8th, not July 1.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I'm glad I asked. I didn't understand that correctly. The second question then, thank you, Mr. Chair, is on the A2 amendment. The amount districts spend to provide these services must be at least equal to. So we're saying that the school district, if they get $10,000 from the state and federal government to provide these services, they have to pass that on. They can't make money on it, but they also aren't going to lose money on it. Is that correct?
That's Mr. Chair and Representative House, that's my understanding, yes.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Faust asked some of what I was concerned about, but this says equal to the federal funds, not the state funds, and so that is different. And, you know, I think when people are, you know, and it does have some ability to say at least, but I'm correct in saying it's just federal funds, and they don't have to provide state funds, right?
Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, my understanding is that the state statute requires them also to do the state funding at the same level. Maybe this isn't sufficiently clear, but that's the understanding that I have. Yeah. So to the extent that the state funds supplement the federal funds, that amount would go to the school.
Perhaps this might be a good time to ask the department to come forward. I know they wanted to speak on this. We'll stick with you, Representative Peterson. To the extent the department has information on that particular point.
Okay.
Good morning, Ms. Barnage.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Would you like me to first try to answer the question?
Please, please. Thank you.
It's my understanding that
you'll question, have to state your name.
I apologize. Lisa Barnes with the Department of Education. If I heard correctly, the question deals with the A2 amendment and whether or not state aid is also proportional. I will have to actually take that question back. My understanding what the A2 amendment might do, though, is require school districts to only go to the federal statutes of our IDEA with children in private or non-public schools. Currently, it's my understanding that in our state, we do provide more than what is required under federal laws for students in private schools or non-public schools. But I can get that answer for you, specifically if proportionally state aid is also supposed to be proportional for children in those schools as well.
Representative Peterson.
No, I think she's answered. She's going to find out if and how much of the state funding is available for those students. It seems to be, at least this language seems to leave it up to the district to determine, because it says at least, and so, which is maybe fine, but I don't know what's in statute currently, so if you could find that out, it would be great. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm more comfortable with the A1, but I still think I want to ask my question. And it's on the back side at the top where it says the district shall ensure. And I was concerned with the language on the original because it talks about homeless and other students. And while you've taken that language out, it still does say that the district shall ensure that every child with a disability is identified, located, and evaluated. And I'm wondering what kind of legal ramifications that may have for a district to have to track down children that are homeless and that are living or not enrolled in a public school, and I guess I'm a little nervous about that.
Mr. Deans, this is a question in your direction, I believe.
Ms. Chairman, Representative Norton, we believe this is the federal child fine requirement. We believe this is a reflection of current law. And the other language that was taken out that dealt with that was that was in current law was just a sort of an explanation. Those things are spoken to in the federal regulations, but it's like saying that this applies to everybody in Minnesota, including Kim Norton. You know, the including clause doesn't have to be there.
Okay, I just
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, if it complies with federal law, certainly that's fine. I just was a little worried about the onus this puts on school districts to be out hunting children down, and then the ramifications legally if some parent eventually down the line says my child had a special need and you never found him. So, but if it's federal law,
the current onus.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, could you just repeat for us what was the impetus for you to bring this bill forward? I just have a couple of questions. In addition to that, is this going to increase the number of students with disabilities that a school district is going to be required to service? And because we're in a time of unfunded mandates, and I'm not really clear, we're talking about what the federal government and the state government, their funding stream. We all know that we have a huge cross-subsidy that goes within the school districts, and I'm concerned about that this is going to be another financial burden on the districts if we're doing anything to change the flow of students into our special needs programs.
Mr. Deans may also want to weigh in on this. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Deputy. No, it does not increase the number of students that would qualify for special ed or would no longer qualify for special ed. And it has no effect on funding either. This is simply to clarify for all of the the interest groups, and especially for our school district, so they have a clear message as to what we're trying to do with special ed. Some of the language has been confusing. We've had differences between federal law and state law, and we're trying to make sure that it's easily interpreted and that the districts have something that they can work with that's clear and uniform.
Mr. Deans, anything to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, last year we had a task force, and then we also had a working group that went through and tried to deal with federal conformity issues in special ed to try to get the things so that we didn't have all these differences between state and federal law. This was one issue that was left at the end that got dropped in the conference committee. I don't believe intentionally. It just got dropped in the conference committee when they were putting the thing back together again. And so we brought it back again this year to pick that last piece up on the age-out issue.
Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to ask the representative from the Department of Education, is the Department of Education in favor of this bill?
This is probably an appropriate time for Ms. Barnidge to give us the testimony that she had prepared for this morning. Ms. Barnidge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and representatives of the committee. The department is thankful to MSBA for the clarification in this bill on the Turning 21. And we do welcome this clarification. We also are really appreciative of the MSBA as well as Representative Newton to continue to work with MDE on our concerns about the bill. We have been working over the weekend and hope to continue work a little bit more. Our main concern does center on the impact that this language has for students enrolled in choice programs, open enrollment in charter schools specifically. But we do understand it is the intention of this bill to not change current statute, but to add clarification. However, the current statute is longstanding, and we are still trying to weigh the impacts of these changes to current statute.
Representative Epke.
You're concerned about schools of choice and charter schools. What about it concerns you specifically?
Ms. Barnidge.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this morning our specialist on this issue did have prior commitments, so I can speak generally. However, she would probably be best to follow up with you on some specifics. I believe it has to deal with the residential district, and how currently children with special needs or with special education in charter schools, I believe the charter schools work with the school districts on the IEPs. Although the current amendment does remove the repealer for FAPE, the original bill had some FAPE provisions repealed that we were just concerned on what that means about the free and appropriate and who is responsible for that education pool.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have the Minnesota School Boards Association. Are they available to testify for this as well?
Madam Chair, that's me.
Mr.
I apologize.
I turned to my staff and said, is Ms. Kelleher here?
Yes, I know.
Are there any other questions? Representative April.
Well, thanks. I'm sorry I was late for this. There's a bunch of things going on, but I was just comment, and maybe I'll just talk to the author later, but the word ensure, sometimes there's words that are impossible to accomplish, and it's the word is used a few times throughout, and maybe as this goes forward, you're creating a standard that nobody can do. The make a heroic effort to accomplish or really try hard to, because, if you're going to ensure, that means if you miss one, then you violated the thing, and the second thing is, there's another, that's one flip. Another flip side of this thing is at some point, I've been a supporter of the disability community quite a bit, but on the other side, you have to find a way to do it in a reasonable way. And you know, if the standard is whatever they need by whoever says they need it, then that's an amount of money nobody can afford. And if this is an effort to bring balance and, you know, really good care to kids who need the extra help, considering all the constraints we're under, then that's probably a productive direction to go in, and it moves the discussion where it needs to go. In an era when we're facing, you know, schools with flat funding into the foreseeable future or worse. So I guess it's just a comment, not a question.
Representative Abel, it's a good comment. Earlier, Representative Norton had raised the issue in the language on 2.1 and 2.2, and the response that we got was that this was language that mirrors a federal child fine requirement. However, I share your anxiety about the legal implications of words like ensure, not unlike some of the NCLB language, no doubt.
And Mr. Chair, and just as this goes forward, and I don't have an amendment available today, and I'm happy to Representative Norton and I think alike on this. It's just another good day in Minnesota. But I think if we don't have to adopt language that the feds give us except as a framework, we are free to choose our own word that actually we can live with and doesn't saddle us with something that we don't intend. And it seems to me like the education is still the primary responsibility of the state. So, with you, Mr. Chair.
Members, wise words from a veteran legislator. And to this point, I believe Representative Dabney and has something to offer on this language.
Dang, Mr. Chair, you no. Set me up. I have to follow wisdom.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a high standard. It is to this point. Thank
all
you.
Right.
My school district's motto is every child college ready. And I've occasionally tussled with them arguing that not every kid wants to go to college and that we actually are sending the wrong message to some kids by saying that. And the pushback that is effective with me is when they look at me and say, okay, then who decides which kid we get to be college ready? And in reference to ensuring that every kid who qualifies, including kids who are homeless and kids who are in families who aren't connected and the like, get found, I would ask the committee to tell me who decides who doesn't have to get found. Who do we leave off? Who do we decide doesn't need to receive the services that they qualify for? If we get rid of words like ensure from our legislation, that maybe we should set the bar high and the aspirations higher. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair.
I'm looking over to Representative Abel to see if he wanted to engage on that. Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair, I understand that Ms. Larson has some language that we might be able to use to substitute for that.
Very well. Ms. Larson, you may have some language that might work here.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the H2867A1 amendment on page 2, line 1, delete, ensure that every child, and insert identify, comma, locate, comma, and evaluate children. And on page 2, again on line 1, delete is and insert are. And on page 2, line 2, delete is identified, located, and evaluated. So that the sentence would read, a district shall identify, locate, and evaluate children with a disability in the district who are in need of special education and related services.
Representative Newton, Mr.
Yes, I'd like to amend the amendment to include that new language, Mr. Chair.
Very well, and I'm seeing nods of the head from at least one of your testifiers, or one of the testifiers, not yours.
That's fine.
The department seems to be nodding as well. So, Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, I just had a comment, if not a question, but, you know, I know that the Minnesota Department of Education has had some trouble identifying little kids and had some, not penalties, but had to have come up with a special plan because they have not identified the number of young kids that they are supposed to. And I just think this is particularly important. It's actually been a big issue with kids under 3. If I could just ask the department to tell us what the status of that sort of plan is now.
Ms. Barnage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solik, I do know that the federal government has told us that based on percentages that we have reported of children identified, that our percentages are too low, and we have been trying to work with school districts, providing more training, and even I believe a couple years ago we even widened some language in the birth to three special education statutes to ensure that we were aligned with federal statutes. I can, Representative Slawick, go back to the department and ask where we are currently with our actions, and I do believe last time I spoke with Early Learning Services that we have been improving that percentage. I'm not for sure when we had to report back to the federal government on our new status.
Mr. Chair, it's probably, I know you're in the middle of language and trying to pass an amendment, but I just think that's very important, is that we all know if we provide the proper interventions for little kids, they're going to come out way better for the K-12 system and so forth, and that we've had trouble in this area. So I think I really support this amendment. I like the word identified in particular, and I think it goes right along with hoping to improve the numbers of kids that we are identifying and locating and evaluating.
Representative Slawick, it is, we are in the middle of amendment, but it is on point, and it is important that these words mean more than just words. Mr. Deans, did you wish to comment? No. All right. Ms. Larson, I wonder if you can repeat the amendment language here that Representative Newton is moving. That Representative Newton is moving.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document H2867A1, page 2, line 1, delete, ensure that every child, and insert identify, comma, locate, comma, and evaluate children. Again, on page 2, line 1, delete is and insert are. On page 2, line 2, delete is identified, located, and evaluated.
Very well, members, we're all clear. The amendment before us. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, I think we're ready to move. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Representative Newton, we were not able to post the A2 amendment online. We try as much as possible. It isn't always possible to post bills and amendments to make sure that the public is aware of the issues before us so that they can have an opportunity to come and testify. I note that we don't have anyone that's offered testimony, nor do I see folks from some of the private and charter school communities. And so I would ask, assuming that we move forward with this, I would ask the author to look for an opportunity to connect with those communities to see if they wish to weigh in. We will no doubt be hearing the bill in K-12 finance if it's successful here. So members, I just wanted to note that. Very well. Then Representative Newton renews his motion that House File 2867 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And members, we won't be acting on any other bills today. I think, do we have minutes to approve? I'm wondering, Representative McFarland, if you would move the March 11th meeting minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll move the minutes of the March 11th.
Thank you. Representative McFarland moves adoption of the minutes of March 11th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, tomorrow we'll be hearing, I forget the number, but it's the House File 3421. I should know that number. It's my bill. This is actually the department's bill forwarding most of the recommendation of the task force on the assessment sort of redesign, if you will, task force that was created with legislation last year. We heard testimony from the task force. We heard a presentation of the bill last week. We heard from the department tomorrow. We'll be acting on the bill. I will be bringing in a an amendment to that. To that bill, I will be sharing that with members sometime today. I will be encouraging to look at that, for you to look at that amendment, and prepare yourselves for discussions on Wednesday morning. This is pretty big and important stuff, folks, and I certainly want to make sure that we're all properly informed and properly engaged. In my mind, these issues of assessments are not partisan issues, but really issues of our acceptance of our common responsibility to make sure that we have a fair, equitable, and proper assessment system that tells us what we need to know about our system and about our kids' learning, but also that create opportunities to enhance the learning of our children. So this is pretty important stuff, and I would urge members to consider it carefully, and certainly to contact me between now and tomorrow morning if you have any concerns or issues that you wish to raise before then. And I don't know if we're scheduled for a meeting on Thursday at this point. Do we have anything lined up? Okay. Well, keep watch notification in regards to our meeting on Thursday. With that, I'm going to ask Representative Greiling if she can present our guests here from out of state, and hopefully we'll have a powerful and good discussion in regards to trust fund lands. Representative Greiling.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'm doing this in substitution for Representative Dietrich, who we all know is our point person and champion for having our school trust lands make more money for our students. And she's, however, up in governmental operations where the bill resides. So today we'll be discussing the bill, and we'll be, those of us also on K-12 finance will be discussing it this afternoon, but we don't have the bill in our possession. So we can't make amendments, but they are making amendments upstairs in governmental operations. And here today we're very fortunate to have with us two experts in school trust lands and champions for having the funding make more profit for schools in Utah. And they make very clear that it's not a trade-off between those of us like myself who are environmentalists and those of us like myself who want more money for our students, that you can do both. And they have done both in Utah. So we're going to get to hear from them and dialogue with them the rest of this committee hearing. So we have Margaret Bird, who is the director of Utah's Children Land Alliance Supporting Schools, acronym CLASS, which is a pretty classy acronym. She's worked 36 years to reform the management of the school trust lands in Utah, where their revenue has increased from $19 million annually to $143 million. Their school trust fund has risen from $18 million to over $1 billion in 2010. She's currently also employed by Utah State Office of Education, works as a consultant for University of Utah and Utah State University on their trust lands, and is a director of the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools. Her nickname, the Junkyard Dog. I see some analogies to her and Representative Dietrich, actually. So, and then with her is Kevin Carter, who is the director of Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, where he leads all activities of the agency and also serves on the Utah Constitutional Defense Council, the Board of Utah Geological Survey, the Natural Resources Coordinating Council, the Utah Generated Renewable Energy Electricity Network Authority Board, and recently the chairman of the Utah Partners for Conservation and Development. He's the person we can ask about, do you care about the environment, and also can work it out with money for schools person. You can hear from his resume. He's got more than 25 years of experience in the management of trust lands, and he pioneered the shift, which we're looking to do here in Minnesota, in the trust land operations from the traditional research management activities to this high return land use. So, Mr. Chair, it's my honor to introduce these two, and I will turn it over to them.
Very well. And welcome, Ms. Bird and Mr. Carter. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Minnesota is, and of course, we're trying to think how to say this. I think we're the farthest eastern state in the nation with substantive trust fund lands. And so in many ways, we feel very much a kinship with our western neighbors in this regard. So we look forward to hearing about your experiences and advice as we wrestle with our important resource here with the trust fund lands. So good morning. Welcome to Minnesota. Welcome to our committee this morning.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. You know, years ago, about 20 years ago, before we made this change in Utah, I sat on the land board. And I recall one day when two young men in our power company came in before the land board and they said, you know, we have a little problem here. When we went to the bond market to fund this $44 million plant we just built, one of those sharp New York attorneys happened to discover that we built the plant on your land, the school land, instead of on our land. And so it's a very simple solution. If you'll just trade us your molehill for our molehill, then everyone can be happy. And I recall that the chairman of that committee was a big rancher from the northern part of the state, and he took his massive arms when the young man had finished and banged him on the table and said, "Boys, it may have been a molehill. It's a gold mine now." And I think that's the message that we're coming to share with you today, is that in Utah, our school trust lands were a molehill when we started, and they are a gold mine today. 16 years ago, when we actually succeeded in making the changes to the management of the lands, Utah was the poster child for how not to manage school trust lands in trust for schools. We had the lowest permanent fund of any state in the nation, probably about 1/15 the size of the next largest permanent fund. We had been issuing, we had coal leases that were out there that were paying 1/10 the royalty that they were paying on the federal coal leases. One out of every three leases that we had, the revenue was given to the wrong beneficiary of that trust. We had the Department of Natural Resources was the agency in charge of the management of our school lands. And with all the conflicts of lands being taken for parks, both national parks and state parks, and we were selling land as low as $25 an acre. And I recall asking one of the young men that was in charge of that sale, "Why did you charge $25 an acre for that property that was on a lake?" And he said, "Well, that was the least I could charge." And that, to me, epitomized the problem that we had at that time. The task at that point seemed undoable to us. We had opposition from the ranching community that thought we were part of No Move by 92 or Cattle Free by 93. We had opposition from the timber industry. There was opposition from the Association of Counties, the oil and gas industry, and the coal industry. You know, it's a funny thing. I remember saying to an attorney, "Why is everyone opposed to this idea when the lands were given to the children, to the schools?" And they said, "You know, it's human nature. We just naturally oppose change." Well, I am pleased to tell you that today, every single one of those groups are now in support of what Mr. Carter and his agency are doing, as well as environmental groups. I think the real turning point occurred as we studied it. The legislature had a two-year task force that studied it, and then there was an additional year of study by the a citizens committee. And the real turning point for each of those groups was when they finally understood what it means to be a trust and what it means to be a trustee. Because in every one of these states, the state was made the trustee of the school lands to act in the best interest with undivided loyalty to those schools for those lands to then be productive for the schools. At the time that we were working on the changes, there was divided loyalty within the agency that was administering it. It had to put out forest fires. It also had to do forestry activities. And it was supposed to be managing the lands. And unfortunately, we have a lot of snow like you do. And there is a short growing season for us in the summer and the fall. And unfortunately, the people were busy on forestry activities when some activities that could have generated money for lands would also have been occurring. And so there was a divided focus also. They were focused in many different directions. The agency was very inefficient. It was the statistics that we gathered, and I saw some of the statistics that you have in your packets, were very similar to the ones that we had in Utah at that time. And it was also not a very transparent agency. It was very hard to get information. It was very hard to get the information that you needed. Several changes were made as we moved through the process, but there were three main areas that we focused on. How can the land make more money for the schools as it was intended, while still respecting, you know, the environment and protection of those lands? It's not about how can we rip off and make the most money in 1 year and then have worthless lands after that. That is not the concept. It's a forever trust. There was also the question about our permanent fund. And then the third, why is this not making a difference in the lives of the children that are in these schools? I will let Mr. Carter address the issues about the agency. But there are a couple of things I would like to point out on the permanent fund. I've seen the results of the investment of your permanent fund. You will want to look at that. As a director of class, we gather information on the total return every year from the permanent fund. And I can tell you, you're among the lowest in the nation. I believe Mississippi is the only state I'm aware of that has a lower return annually than you're getting on your fund. And your fund is much larger than that in Mississippi. Utah's fund has gone in this period of time from $18 million to over $1 billion in the permanent fund. It is also, we've all seen what's happened. We've looked at it in our own 401ks and other investments of the permanent fund. We are not talking about doing things that are not prudent. We are talking about being very prudent in the investment of this fund. The largest investment fund in the nation was the Harvard Endowment Fund. And they, because they were not prudent, have now experienced a drop in that fund's value that will take them 100 years to dig out of that hole. In Utah, we also experienced some drop in our fund during the drop in the markets. But I'm pleased to tell you that we're back up and over where we used to be in that fund in about 18 months. So it's important. In Utah, one of the changes that we made is we set up an independent investment advisory committee that advised the state on the investment of that permanent fund. This committee is composed of the smartest financial people we have in the state, the ones who invest the hundreds of millions of dollars in endowment funds, the ones that are the chief financial officers for the largest corporations. That has made a tremendous difference in how we invest that fund and how protected it is in down times. I would suggest to you that you may want to also look at that. But perhaps to me, as a former school teacher, elementary and high school calculus teacher, the thing that really mattered to me in the end was we have changed where the money goes. In our state, that I also understand in your state, all of the money from this trust was going into the big education pot. And the truth is, no one could point to why education was better because that money went there, because the children had the trust. It was sort of like the pot was a certain size, and people were not even aware there were school lands. And the change that we made in Utah is we created something called school community councils in every single school. So there was a council in every school of parents elected by the parents, teachers elected by the teachers, and the principal. And that school community council then made the decisions of how to use the money that came from the trust. The money from that trust goes out to every single school in our state. And they had to develop an academic program of what they needed in their school. And that has made a tremendous difference. There are now 8,000 people that sit on these committees across the state, and they really care what kind of job Mr. Carter does and what kind of job the Investment Advisory Committee does on the investments.
What would be an example of an amount?
Representative Slawick.
$1,000? It depends on the size of the school. There are some high schools that get as much as $100,000. There are smaller high schools, little tiny, tiny high schools that probably are more in the neighborhood of $15,000. So it's not a whole lot of money, but as you all know, it's discretionary money that can be spent at that level. And most schools do not have much discretionary money to implement an incredible reading program or some fabulous math program that they have seen. They just don't have at their disposal that kind of money. All of a sudden, with the creation of the School Land Trust Program, and you can go on the website, it's www.schoollandtrust.org, and talk about transparent. It's a paperless system. Every single school enters their plan for that year and the implementation of that plan, and so you can see what's been done in every school every year in the entire state. And it's not really more money to schools, but it's different money to schools because it's money that particular school can address their problems. Some of our schools have large populations that are English as a second language schools, and it allows them to concentrate on bringing those children up to the level they need to be on learning English. In other schools, they may be doing fabulously in reading and in math, but they may not have the equipment they need in the science lab. It puts in computer labs, and I think Representative Dietrich has a role of, we have stickers that we stick on every item that's purchased with the school trust land money, so we don't put it on teachers, but everything else we put it on, and they put the stickers on to indicate that it was purchased with trust land. So it's bringing an awareness all over our state about what these lands are doing to help our schools. When we started, as I said, it was a molehill. We were at $18 million, making less than $20 million a year. It's now a gold mine. Mr. Carter, last fiscal year, it's 140, 160. I can't remember what the net amount was. But anyway, from those very same lands, just managed differently. It's an incredible opportunity that you have in front of you to honor the trust that your state was given. You have an opportunity to really honor it and help the students. Almost every state east of you, except the original 13 colonies, once had school trust lands. They have all lost it. Mississippi, I think, is the only, I don't know my geography well enough to know whether Minnesota is a little more eastern than Mississippi or not when it gets down to that point, but I think they are slightly east of you, but I could be off. But Mississippi still has school trust lands, but every other state east of you in Mississippi has lost everything. They've lost their lands. They've lost their permanent funds. And I believe it's because people started calling them state lands, and it was the law of the commons, and pretty soon it had disappeared. So you have an incredible opportunity in front of you to really honor this trust that was a founding document of our country when they created these lands in every single state except the original 13, because they had no federal land. So it's I hope that you find a way to make it where it works for Minnesota, but that it's a gold mine for the Minnesota children also. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Byrd. I just want to do a time check for the committee and for our visitors. We have a little bit over 15 minutes left in this committee time. So I know we want to get some questions as well. Mr. Carter, welcome.
Thank you very much. I will be cognizant of the time restraints and move through this as quickly as I can.
Thank you.
Just to show you an example of what we were and what we changed to become. This was the pre-1994 model. I would, in many respects, similar to the model here in Minnesota now, where there's a Department of Natural Resources, probably the executive director's a cabinet-level position in the governor's office. There was a state land office, wildlife resources, state parks, oil, gas, and mining, several others all fell underneath the Department of Natural Resources. There was a state land board. They were not in a line authority over the state land office, but they provided some policy guidance and made decisions on some lease actions. The director of the Division of State Lands and Forestry served at the pleasure of the executive director of the Department of Natural Resources, which essentially meant he served at the pleasure of the governor, since the executive director of DNR was a cabinet-level position. The revenue went to subsidize a number of things beyond just going to the schools. The management was pretty much based on the federal model of the Forest Service and the BLM, and the majority of the employees in the office were civil service employees like all other state employees. With the change in 1994, the Trust Lands Administration became an independent or quasi-independent agency within the state. Although considered in the executive branch, the director does not serve at the pleasure of the governor and is independent of that. We've broken the agency into four main income groups: oil and gas, surface administration, real estate, and then hard rock, minerals, and coal. The Board of Trustees in this model plays a prominent role. The director serves at the pleasure of the Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees make all policy decisions. The Board of Trustees establishes the budget, which is then submitted to the legislature for approval. So very hands-on, a business type of model. The director is appointed for a term of office. This was done so that there would be some belief that there was independence and he would be in a position to make decisions without worrying about some political consequences. We're entirely self-funded. We're funded from our revenues, and there's no other tax monies or other monies that come to help support the operations of the agency. And then many of the employees have been given the opportunity to move from civil service to an at-will position with monetary incentive to do so, and most have made that choice to do that. So right now almost all of the non-clerical employees of the administration are at will, similar in focus to a business model. The Utah Supreme Court has had several opportunities to look at trust land management in Utah, and their most recent opinion has clearly stated what they believe our obligations are. And essentially, they believe that the trust that Congress set up with the state of Utah, and I would argue similarly with Minnesota, is like any other trust you might set up for your children or your grandchildren, where there is a duty of undivided loyalty, where that the duty is to provide, in this case, for the financial support of the beneficiaries. Some had argued that certainly children are benefited by open space, and that we should be managing some of their lands for open space. While I believe open space is an important asset and benefit for children, that's not what this trust is about. This is a financial trust. And then the beneficiaries of the trust aren't everybody else, and it shouldn't be subsidizing everybody else. It's for the school children. This is a chart that shows revenues from when we began in 1994 up through the most recent fiscal year, ended June of 2009. If you would have taken this chart and ran it off to the left from 1984, continuing backwards in time, you wouldn't have seen much change for the previous 40 years. Revenues averaged from $10 to $20 million net revenues per year for the preceding 20 to 40 years before that also. And so the change substantively began in 1994. As Ms. Bird has mentioned, the permanent fund balance, Utah became a state in 1896, so from 1896 to 1996, about 100 years, we had managed to sock away about $50 million in our permanent fund. and then from 1996 onward, we had established a goal in the early part of the 2000s to reach $1 billion by 2010, and on December 31st, 2009, the balance was at $1,023,000,000 and change, and so we were thrilled to have made it, especially. We had sniffed it in 2008 before the market dropped away from us, and were afraid that we had lost our chance, but we were able to come back pretty strongly and meet it. Much like Minnesota, we also have some very important natural resources in our state. Cultural resources is one that I think we share with you with a lot of historic Native American occupation situation, and this particular petroglyph is on school trust lands. It's a world famous one. It's called the Hunter Panel or the Great Hunt, and in Utah we have a state statute that essentially mirrors the Federal Antiquities Act, and so we provide the same degree of cultural resource protection on trust lands that are provided on federal lands. And we don't see any conflict with that in our mandate. Primarily, we impose upon our lessees and those that want to use the land the cost of following through with these other obligations that any other developer in the state would have to follow up on. In this case, this particular panel was so close to a road that had been built there that if a truck with wide mirrors could scratch it as they went by. And so we took the effort to work with the archaeological community, local government leaders, and instead relocated the road, and actually with an oil company, relocated a road, built the barricade to protect the site, and have come up with a product here in this particular canyon that is so favorably recognized that the federal government and other local groups that have resources like this are following our model in how to protect these sites. This panel has always just been amazing to me. I swear that this has got to be the Kool-Aid Man. I don't know how they could have known, but that's got to be.
Just needs a smiley face.
Like every place else in the country, we have endangered species issues. Animals are protected under the Endangered Species Act regardless of the landowner. So if you happen to have an endangered species in your backyard, you are subject to the Endangered Species Act for that critter. And they have promulgated rules so that the taking of an endangered species is as broadly construed as to harass them, and the penalty can be $250,000 per take. So it's not anything to play around with. Plants, alternatively, are only protected on federal lands. If you happen to have an endangered plant species in your backyard, you can mow it every time you mow your back lawn, and you're not breaking the law. We have made an effort where we have plant species on trust lands to get those lands out of our ownership and into some other ownership. We work hand in glove with the Nature Conservancy in Utah. We probably have as strong a working relationship with the Nature Conservancy as with any other industry group that we work with. And they acquire a lot of lands from us. We have the ability to sell privately. We don't have to sell all of our lands at auction, but we do sell at fair market value. And we would negotiate sales with them and allow them to acquire lands that we probably shouldn't be the owner of because of our mandate. For animals, a different story. We try to work with the federal government to get those lands into federal ownership. But there are other alternatives. One of the endangered species in Utah is the Utah prairie dog. It's a critter that's endemic to two or three counties in southwestern Utah. It had pretty much brought to a standstill development in a local community down there where they could no longer sustain any kind of residential development because of habitat for the Utah prairie dog. And so we worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service, found an area in a different location that could serve as habitat for the prairie dog, dedicated that land for prairie dog habitation, prepared it so that they could survive there, and then they transplant animals from areas in southern, southwestern Utah to this preserve at a cost. And we extract the cost for housing prairie dogs, if you will, on our property. And the homeowners are able to build their homes and proceed. And everybody seems to be happy with the solution. We found a way to put a piece of property that otherwise was not very productive to a very beneficial use. I think the relocation cost was about $2,000 per prairie dog. But development was allowed to continue. The species is protected and preserved, and it's expanding in its range. And it was a win-win opportunity. So I guess the message that I'm trying to say is that there is not a barrier between trust land management and resource protection. You can find a way to accomplish both things if you want to. We have sensitive lands in Utah, like I'm sure you have sensitive lands also. This is what the boundary waters would look like in 2 million years with no water. But there's no question that there are lands that we shouldn't be the owner of. You know, we don't have any way to be the long-term owner of a piece of property like this. And so we find ways to not be the owner of it. You know, we find ways to get it into federal ownership or some other ownership and instead acquire lands that everybody is that understands that the best use of those lands is to develop for minerals or for timber or for some other resource. And since we are a perpetual trust, we have the time to do that. I mean, I have 3.5 million acres I have to manage. I don't have to manage every acre every day. I can set lands like this aside until I have time to deal with getting them out of my ownership so that they're not at risk, but they're just there for a while. But they're not at risk. There's no pressure. And I can focus on the lands that I can do stuff on right now while in the background I'm working on moving out of this land ownership and into better land ownership. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. And thank you, Ms. Burr. We have a few minutes for a few questions or comments. Representative Slawick. Mr. Carter, I thought that was a dead picture for the boundary waters. I think you did shoot that somewhere up north. So.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Slawick.
Yeah, I grew up in Tucson, so I'm familiar with prairie dogs. I don't know, $2,000 a prairie dog, that's a lot. But interesting model. So I'm just trying to figure the very basics. You increased, not just through the stock market, but you're selling the land and turning it over and then buying land that's more profitable all the time. Is that, I'm trying to figure out the basic formula, how you grew so quickly and the value grew so quickly. And just briefly, just the second question, your distribution goes to these school councils. Does it also go to the general fund at all?
That's a very exciting concept, by the way, the school councils. Mr. Carter.
I'll address your first question. We use every legal mechanism we can find to put our lands to use. We have lands leased for oil and gas development. We have lands leased for geothermal, for wind power, coal mining. On the surface side of things, grazing, forestry, telecommunication sites, farming, every legal use that you can think of. We also sell land at auction. We sell about 5,000 acres a year just at auction. You need to remember the paradigm that we're in. 67% of Utah is federally owned. And so that's land that will never go into private ownership now. And we are the only source of private land, of potential private land now with our school trust land. So we are still moving some land into private ownership. We also have a very active program where we partner with real estate developers. We provide land, they come in with capital and expertise, develop a subdivision, and we split the profits. And so, yeah, so just every legal, feasible method that any landowner is used to make money from their lands, we're trying to be into it.
And Ms. Bird, I think the first part of, or the other part of that question.
I'll take the second question. And no, the revenue from the trust does not go into the general fund. The revenue from the trust goes into the net revenue. Their expenses are paid, and then the net revenue goes into the permanent fund. And the capital gains stay in the fund to grow the fund over time. But the interest and dividends goes out to the schools. And it there are no administrative costs held out by my office, the State Office of Education, or by the districts. The money goes directly to each school. That's all on the website. Everyone in the school knows how much their school got. They know what's happening with that money. If they're not pleased with where the money is being spent, they can elect somebody else to be on that school community council and spend it in a different area. So it keeps very much local control and local support. It builds a constituency that supports the activities of Mr. Carter's group, which has been wonderful.
Members, unfortunately, we are at the end of our meeting time. My understanding is that Ms. Byrd and Mr. Carter will also be testifying later in Representative Greiling's committee. Is that correct, Representative Greiling?
That's correct.
And so I would invite members to sit in. A number of our members are also members there. I just simply want to extend our kindred celebration for your forward movement with your trust lands in Utah on behalf of the children. And we, Representative Greiling, I think, said it right. We have our own, I got to be careful. Is it junkyard watchdog or
junkyard dog
and Representative Dietrich, who has been inexorably moving forward, moving us forward into an alternative vision that perhaps will look a lot like your successful vision in your state. And so we look forward to our continued association and learning from your experiences. So thank you for taking the travel out east to Minnesota. Look forward to our continued association.
Thank you, Chairman.
Members, with that, this committee stands adjourned.